Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. How did I
Someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil. There's no place for ghost stories in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Welcome back to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, my monthly interview series where I sit down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry. Today, very special guest, Jeff Keighley. You're about to see him on Gamescom opening night live. He has really become one of the big primary faces of spreading the message of video games throughout pop culture, the Game Awards, E3 Game Critics Awards, etc., etc. Jeff, good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, McCaffrey. I was spreading something. I was worried what you were going to say, but I was spreading good news. All right.
No, never know in a COVID world. Normally, we get to hang out and chat for a while during E3 Judges Week in May down in Santa Monica. So I figure we didn't get that this year. Why not just have this conversation on the air? We'll catch up with.
Yeah, no, I remember we had talked about doing this. I think in March around GDC. When I was going to be up there, and that didn't happen. That's when I was working on the Half-Life Alyx stuff and everything. So yeah, I'm a big fan of the show. I've been watching for years. So fun to be on here with you and just talk about things. I'm always hosting things. I never get to talk about games as often. So this is fun for me.
Yeah, turn the tables a little bit. And this is like the inside the actor studio thing, kind of, as you know. So we like to dive back into the past because so it turns out you and I are almost the same age. We're about exactly a year apart. So yeah. Were you an NES kid? Like me, or what was your early into the games?
For sure. Like, had NES, Genesis, like all that stuff. I remember my brother and I would get the ROMs from Japan. I grew up in Toronto, Canada. So it's like we'd get, ROMs with the adapters and things like that. And we would play a ton of NES stuff. But I probably identify more as a PC gamer to start, at least. Like, I was playing all that stuff, but the family computer at home, where I would play like the early adventure games, those were the ones that I think really like grabbed me more than some of the console stuff. So again, I was playing NES stuff, but it was the like Monkey Islands and the original Sierra adventure games, like the Space Quest, Police Quest, Leisure Suit Larry, Quest for Glory, Gabriel Knight, like all that. That was the kind of stuff that really, I think, got me into games in a big way. And those are some of my most resonant memories. But of course, I was like, consoles were downstairs on the TV, and then in the family room was the PC.
Boy, see, I knew there's a reason we get along. It's because we like the same games. Yeah. And now, you fast forward in your career, I'll bet like me, you've probably had a lot of moments where you meet some of these people, like whether it's Ron Gilbert or Tim Schafer, some of these adventure game designers and heroes, where you think like, boy, if I could go back to my 12-year-old self and show him this moment, his head would explode.
Oh, well, that was like, what's amazing to me is when Tim Schafer, I consider a good friend. And it's like, this is a guy with like Day of the Tentacle and Monkey Island and Full Throttle. I mean, these are games that I really idolize. And, the whole reason I kind of was able to get into games was because why I got so excited about the industry was I got to meet a lot of these designers virtually when I was a kid. Right. And then I was, got to beta test a lot of the early Sierra games all online. So that's kind of really when I fell in love with the creative process behind games, was like getting to like file bugs to Al Lowe on like Freddy Farkas, Frontier Pharmacist, and like all these games back in the day. I got to know these guys virtually, and I was just a kid. I was like a, 12 or 13 year old kid in Canada who was dialing up to the Sierra BBS and trying to limit how many minutes I was on, because you got charged by the minute to like get to the hint line to figure things out. I like had an appreciation of those games. And then I was just so lucky as a kid that I wrote a letter to Sierra Online saying, I love your games. How do you make them? And I got a response back saying, well, we'd love you to help us make them. Here's a beta version of a game. And that's like how it all started for me.
That's insane. Like that's one of those things where it's like, you never know. You put it out there. you put good out there and good comes back, right? It's just kind of wild how life works sometimes.
No, I say to people time and again, just take the risk, right? And take the leap. Like you said, I was a 12-year-old kid in Canada, and I just wrote a letter and like mailed it via traditional mail from Toronto, Canada, Oakhurst, California. And basically, I don't have the letter. I wish I did, but I said to Sierra, like, I love your games. I'd love to learn more about how you make them. And this lady, her name, I still remember, Gan O'Hane, responded back to me and said, Jeff, thank you so much for your note. You know, we do beta testing on games, and we have a new game coming up called EcoQuest 2, the Search for Cetus. And we'd love you to sort of like help us play this and tell us what you think. And he said it was just like right place, right time. I'm so honored that happened. But I tell people again and again, like, just email, like, and I, you know, just email Gabe Newell, email Phil Spencer. And like, you'd be surprised. I mean, and the industry has changed, obviously, from those days. But I always, like, even now with Game Awards, I'll just like take a risk and like, you know, email Elon Musk about come to the show. And it's like, he'll show up. And it's just like, it's just one of those things. Like, I just say people, like, especially in the internet, like, just reach out to people, see what happens.
Yeah, because it's I'm the same way, where it's, you know, it's what's the worst they can say is no, right?
That's or just not respond. And it's just like, this is, I get ignored all the time. And like my, you know, my world is there's a lot of rejection when, you know, you're booking the Game Awards, and people always say, like, why didn't you have this game or that game? It's like, you know, I asked Valve for, you know, a decade to like come show, you know, a Half-Life or something. And like every year it's like, don't have anything ready for you. And it's like, we ask all the same questions, and you just have to be used to like getting the no's. But yeah, like I've always been a fan of just reaching out, asking people, staying in touch with folks. And as you said, worst case is they don't respond or they say no, but there might actually be an opportunity there.
Yeah. So along these lines, this was I didn't know this about you. This is on your Wikipedia page from a Los Angeles Times piece on you. Says it said Keeley's first foray, or not first, but Keeley's foray into video game reporting and presentation had been through Cybermania 94, the Ultimate Games Awards, the first video game awards show broadcast on television. Keeley was 14 at the time, but was brought in to help write lines for the celebrity hosts to read. The show was not considered successful, aimed more for comedy than celebration, but from it, Keeley was inspired to develop some type of equivalent of the Academy Awards for video games in his career. So how on earth do you manage to get roped in and you're writing on an award show at age 14?
I know this is like one of those strange coincidences, but I had started writing for I think it was Strategy Plus magazine when I was a kid, right? So I started, what the quick story is, I started beta testing games. I was on CompuServe. I knew a lot about these games when they came out because I beta tested them. So I would kind of give people hints and tips. An editor from Strategy Plus reached out to me saying, hey, you seem to know a lot about games. You want to write for our magazine? So that started when I was like 13. I previewed Will Wright's Sim Farm was the first big preview I wrote. And then it just happened, I think the next year, that this award show for video games was being produced out of Toronto by a friend of my dad.
In the backyard.
And he heard thing from my dad's like, oh, my son's kind of into this video game thing. He's like, oh, well, that's great, because I have all these writers that know nothing about video games and need to learn about them quickly, because we're doing this award show for TBS at Universal Studios in Hollywood. So can you come in and help us? So yeah, I became you can still watch this show on YouTube. There's a version of it. It's hosted by the late, great Leslie Nielsen from Naked Gun and Jonathan Taylor Thomas from Home Improvement. And I got the title of Interactive Product Specialist on that show. And yeah, I wrote dialogue for William Shatner to narrate during the nominee packages. So he was like describing Myst and Mortal Kombat and Doom. And yeah, it was like insane. And I got to go down to Universal Studios Hollywood. I think it was like the set of the Conan stunt show is where they did this. And I got to sit in the audience with my dad and see this award show for video games, which was like trippy and weird. Like Herbie Hancock performed, Will Arnett, like read cheat codes for arcade games. And they went like live to him when he was it was just like, and I think best action game was presented by Matthew Perry and Hilary Swank to Jay Wilbur from id for Doom. And it was just like, it's funny, like how everything comes together. But yeah, I worked on that, and there wasn't a Cybermania 95, but it definitely inspired me to think of award shows and people now always think of me, oh, he's the Spike VGA guy or he's the G4ia guy. But yeah, it actually started way back in 1994.
So at that point, I mean, your dad's got a front row seat to this, like literally with you. Are your parents super supportive? Like, what was there an idea of? Yeah. Was this always what you wanted to do, or did you kind of have other ambitions of? Well, all right, when I go when I get out of high school, I'll go to college, and then I want to do X.
Yeah, they were all very supportive. I mean, when I was a kid, like, you know, they had to buy me a 3DO, and that was like, you know, $1,000 in Canada or something like that. And they like, you know, I got one when I was playing my. You know, my crash and burn on 3DO or something. Yeah, so they were always supportive. And I, you know, I went through high school and all of college. I moved down to the States and went to USC for college. But all through high school and college, I was writing about video games. That's what I did, right? I've never had another job or a traditional job, right? Yeah. I've always just kind of like done writing about games. And I always say to people, I was lucky that when I was in college, I was able to like freelance and write about games, but do it in like a subtle way where it's like I could never make enough money to really make a career out of it, but I didn't need it to be a career because it was kind of a job on the side. So yeah, all through college, I was like writing for magazines primarily. I, you know, I started my Final Hours series. I went to Valve in 1997, 1998 when they were doing Half-Life. So yeah, their parents were always supportive. And then I went to college. I was thinking of maybe going to law school. And I got into a bunch of law schools and kind of decided to defer it and just never honestly got back to it. And it just kind of became a career naturally over time. And I graduated and then G4 was starting and there was all this TV stuff and YouTube. And I just kind of like never went to law school and it became a career sort of right when it needed to become one. And that's why people always ask, you know, how are you able to get these guests or these, you know, games on the show. And it's because I've known a lot of these people for 20 or 30 years as part of the industry. And you know, it's like you've been around, it's like it's all kind of the same people like making the games, yeah. Which is, you know, good and bad. But yeah, it's a lot of the same people. So yeah, parents are super supportive and I made it a career sort of honestly, not even deliberately. Like I didn't have a goal of like one day I'm going to do this crazy big award show for video games by myself. That was just a natural course of sort of what happened with G4 and Spike and the desire to do that. I think my goal has always been to like try and elevate this industry and have people understand and respect it. And like you, when I was growing up, it's like games weren't the cool thing to do. People didn't really understand that. Like, I remember on my college application, I wrote something about a CD-ROM. And the admissions office called me back and said, like, what is this? Is this a misspelling? What's a CD-ROM? And they just had like no concept of what I was talking about. But I was like so passionate about this medium and games for where they were going to take entertainment. And it's nice now that, you know, I feel like finally, especially this year, games, people are appreciating the power of this entertainment form. But I was just so taken by it. I said, of course, like, this is the future of entertainment. I got to wrap myself around it. I'm so interested in the games, interested in the people that make them. Let me find a way to like celebrate that. And you know, I was never necessarily always like a previews or reviews guy. I was interested in like the features and the people and the stories behind the games.
So your parents never tried to nudge you towards the law school or express any disappointment when you didn't go? They wholly embraced enthusiasm?
They've been like super, super supportive. And I'm grateful for that, right? That it was, like I was trying to figure out like what was the business around what I was doing. And yeah, it was, I think they liked that I had a passion and also like games, you know, kind of kept me out of trouble in many ways, right? I was like, you know, playing games, writing about games. I wasn't partying. I wasn't, you know, I was just kind of like, I did well in school. It wasn't like I was, you know, binging on games and not doing my schoolwork and stuff like that. So yeah, I just kind of managed it and kept to myself. And as I said, like games kind of kept me out of trouble. And I think that was meaningful to them. And yeah, I just like slowly built it into a business. But yeah, there was not a lot of pressure of like, hey, this video game thing, what is it? Cause like right after college, I started writing for like Time Magazine and Entertainment Weekly and got like some much bigger prominent gaming things. So it was growing and it wasn't like I was, you know, only writing for EGM or something, nothing against EGM, but it just, I think my parents were like, wow, like he's doing like Time Magazine. He's writing about video games. That's cool. So yeah, always been like super supportive, and I'm lucky in that way.
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it? Because I was the same way. Like I was from, I would say it was about high school when I was reading, you know, I read EGM as a kid, and then I went like exclusively to PC gaming. So PC Gamer I would read every month. And I just said, you know what? Writing is my best subject. I enjoy it. I'm going to write about video games. That's what's going to happen. And I was just like laser focused, and there was no backup plan. That was it. But my parents, yeah, same thing, were never like, well, no, you've got to figure out something to do. And it's just, you've got the support of parental support is just so important for that'd be not that I'm any kind of expert, but to any parents out there, just nurture those enthusiasms.
Yeah, and look, you know, you and I both, I think, had a passion too, right? And I always say, like, it's, you know, I feel like I've never really worked a day in my life. Like, I just love what I do, and it's like, it's not, yeah, work, you know, it's not like, oh man, I gotta go figure out what announcements we're gonna have at the Game Awards. I'm like jazzed to like see these games and, you know, pushing for awesome stuff. So yeah, I think my parents and other people just sensed that it was something that I was like, you know, really excited about, and just naturally grew into something organically. Same thing with you. It's like I love what I do. I never saw games as this bridge to like, oh, I'm going to do a great Game Awards show, and then I'm going to like go produce the Oscars. Like, that's never been my end game. It's like games have been what, you know, define my career. And even when I've, you know, I started writing some more traditional journalism stuff for Time. I did like a big story about Cirque du Soleil and like a feature on Matt Drudge and Drudge Report. And like, I had fun doing that stuff. But I always just like kept coming back to games because it just felt the most interesting and compelling to me, because this industry, you know, the technology is always improving, the games are always getting better. It's never bored me, and that just has ended up kind of just defining my career. And now, as you said, you and I get older, it's like, this is kind of what I do. And I'm really like, yeah, I'm so honored and lucky that I found that passion early. Right. And I have lots of friends that I think are still trying to like figure out like, well, what are they really passionate about? What do they want to do? And like for me, yeah, when I found games when I was 12 or 13, I'm just like so grateful that I found that. As you said, I had the environment to support that passion, and I was able to turn it into a career. And not everyone is that lucky that they find something they're, you know, that passionate about when they're that young. So I'm grateful for that.
How old were you when you started GameSlice?
GameSlice, I started in 1996. So I don't know. I guess I was like mid-teens. And that was, a couple years after Cybermania. And I wanted to launch a website about games. And it was like the early days of the internet, right? It was like, you know, like, mm-hmm, Next Gen might have been around, but it was like Super Intelligent Gamer, I remember. There were a couple other big websites in the mid-90s. And I launched that as a CompuServe form and as a website at the same time. And yeah, I was in high school then still. I launched that as like my first kind of venture on the web, and still keep my email address the same as it was, you know, 25 years ago. And that was, you know, you can go back to the Wayback Machine and still find like, you know, GameSlice from 1995 and 96 and 97, which is fun for me actually to like, I think I launched it with a preview of Hexen from Raven, which was the sequel to Heretic. And that's what we kind of like, yep, kicked it off with. It was fun. Like, I would do my E3 coverage there. I would like write about games. I did when I went to college, I ended up doing a daily blog almost on GameSlice called The Gist List, which was like a kind of list of like what I thought was cool and not in the gaming industry. It was like a lot of work. And I now see all these content creators and friends that do YouTube videos daily. And I'm like, I still have nightmares of like the pressure to like every day write a blog. But I would go to the computer lab at USC and like write a blog every day and like post it to this website. And I did that for a lot of college, which was insane thinking back. But yeah, I launched it in high school and then carried it all through through college as a website about games.
And then a bit after that, I remember you did the back page column for us at Official Xbox Magazine for a good little while there.
Yeah, that was probably college, post-college. Yeah, that's why I was doing like a lot of freelance writing, right? It wasn't even like, yeah, the video stuff wasn't a part of it. Like, I was behind the scenes on Cybermania. I primarily wrote like reviews for like Entertainment Weekly for a long time. I was like the video game guy that like wrote a lot of reviews and features there. I was doing my behind the games kind of final hours stories every couple of years. So I did like Quake 3. I did Black and White with Peter Molyneux. I did Prince of Persia Sands of Time with Ubisoft. And I was sort of, you know, every couple of years I do a big game and a story on that. But yeah, the on-camera stuff and video stuff didn't really start till probably like the early 2000s. When Victor Lucas, who you know well, like, you know, asked me to start hosting some stuff for Electric Playground. And that really sort of like became the next phase of my career, you know, with doing things on camera.
So you mentioned Final Hours convincing Gabe Newell to let you come down and do the last little bit, profile that the end run of that game. It goes back to what you were saying earlier. You just email, right? That's all it takes sometimes.
Yes. It's a little harder now than it probably was in the 1990s. But yeah, I was like, and again, Half-Life, you know, you got to remember like that was kind of nothing, right? No one knew.
Right. It was an unknown quantity.
And I had written for Sierra had a magazine called Interaction, which was like their, you know, probably remember like their kind of quarterly magazine where they would preview their games that were coming up. I think I'd written a story about Half-Life for that. And yeah, I just got like really interested in it. I'm like, I think there's kind of something interesting to do here. I wrote a story about the making of Unreal. That was the first kind of behind the scenes that I did. And then, yeah, Half-Life was the next one. It was just like a game I was excited about. And back then, Gabe was like a nobody, right? They were just like a bunch of ex-Microsoft guys were trying to make a game. So he was like, cool, this guy wants to come and spend, you know, a couple days with us. And I flew up with Genevieve Waldman, who's still in the industry, and we went to visit Valve and did like this story with you know, Gabe and Doug Lombardi and all these folks back then. And again, like I always say, it's a great example of just, you sometimes have to bet on things that might not pay off for a long time, but you're just excited about naturally. And you know, now obviously I know the Valve guys incredibly well, and I've kind of charted the whole course of that company. But yeah, sometimes you just have to like reach out and take a risk. And again, like, you know, it sounds weird now that they would say yes, but back then you got to remember, yeah, Gabe was like a small little studio that didn't even know if their game was going to work. I got lucky in a way too with that one.
Yeah. There were no real like gatekeepers. Like, cause I actually have not quite that story, but Gabe used to go on IRC channels, like gaming IRC channels. And that I would hang out in those things. I was in college too. I guess I would have been probably a year behind you, and same thing, following the game through PC Gamer. And I remember catching Gabe in IRC once and asking him if I could beta test Half-Life. And he literally sent me an RC4, Release Candidate 4 disc of the original Half-Life, which I wish I still had somewhere.
I was going to say, I have like all my alphas and betas from the original Half-Life. And whenever I show them, there's like this internet furor that like released the betas or alphas. And yeah, I kept all those discs just because there was something special about that game. But yeah, he said that's like back in the day, it's hard for people to realize like, It was a different issue. It was just smaller, and it's like it was, but you know, really good people, right? And that's part of the reason I think I've always stayed in games is that I really like the people in it. It's a really honest, good industry, and that's why I've never kind of wanted to go elsewhere, because I really like just love the people in it.
So fast forward, now you've just done. You're not here for your health. We're here to promote Jeff Keighley. You've got Opening Night Live, of course, the Game Awards, which I'm going to ask you about later. But you've also just finished, available now on Steam, The Final Hours of Half-Life Alyx, where you went back and chronicled the sort of stretch development, although it covers a lot more than just the end of development. It covers really the whole thing, the whole process of making a Half-Life VR game, and the sort of internal fears and trepidations and dangers that came along with that. And so what I wanted to ask you is, besides telling people that they should go check it out, because it's this cool Steam app that's interactive and it's got some cool game assets in it, a lot of never before seen stuff. But I wanted to ask you, without spoilers, what was your reaction when you first finished Alyx to the end of that game?
So it always gets a little spoiled for me because I'm, you know, kind of aware of what they're doing, but so I played, and I don't know how much we want to spoil the end of it, but when I played it, it was a little unclear to me what was going on, because I'll speak in code without giving it away, but there's sort of a credit sequence in between two things. When I played it, there wasn't a credit sequence. It just went right into the thing afterwards. So I thought there was sort of this weird body transform. Like, I didn't know what was going on. I remember saying to Eric Wopan stuff. I'm like, what happened there? So it was a little unclear. It's like the surprise is sometimes spoiled for me because I see things in development. But yeah, the Valve guys thought for a long time about kind of how to wrap this up. What was the right coda for it? So I was like, I was really excited with what I saw at the end of the game, but it was something I remember being confused by it. And they were like, yeah, we need to clarify that because like the dialogue wasn't in and there wasn't this credit sequence to break these two things apart. But yeah, it was a real experience playing that. And, I was so excited that Valve was doing that. And, I had taken a break from doing Final Hours for probably about 5 years, right? Last one I did was Titanfall, just because I got so busy with Game Awards. And those projects are, I don't have a ghostwriter. Like, I really do all that myself, like all the interviews, all the transcripts. And this one, like, was so confidential, I had to transcribe myself because, I couldn't even trust some online transcript service. And Valve was obviously concerned about, anything leaking about, what happened with Half-Life 3, et cetera, et cetera. So, I was really excited when I finally found out they were really going to do it and really felt it was happening. That was just such joy because, for so many years, I would always – sometimes I'll daydream about, what am I going to do at Game Awards? And I always for years would, imagine the moment of, this figure in the shadows with a crowbar and people realize, oh, my God, it's Gabe. And, walking out on stage and showing, something new Half-Life. And that's the kind of stuff, I'm weird. That gets me really excited to just think maybe that one day that was going to come. And for a long time, I just never thought they were going to touch it again. And there'd been so many different things. So when I got to play it and it still had the magic of Half-Life in it, just brought me such great joy that to see that world back alive again after so many years. And that's what really compelled me to say, we have to tell the story of what happened here. And again, now, of course, people are like, that's not enough. Where's Half-Life 3? But it was, I really love the ending and I love how they did something different with it. And also how modern and high tech and relevant that game felt. Wasn't, some kludgy VR version of Half-Life 2. That was a true next generation Half-Life game.
Well, for me, it's the game. It's the VR game that we always imagined that VR would be when those VR arcades first popped up in the malls in the 90s. Yep. And it's like, this is finally that. We've finally been waiting for 20 years. Here it is.
The combat and everything was, just so great. And you're so active. It's such an experience. And I hate that more people can't get that experience because it's not that accessible and that you have to have, a VR headset and PC and everything. But yeah, as an experience this year, it's such a powerful game. When I finally played the final version in March, just all the little tweaks and elements, it's great for me. I fall more in love with games when I see the creative process of what they go through and how these things come online. And it destroys a little bit of the magic for me that, the games are spoiled for me in advance, but I'm happy to do it because I appreciate the process that they all go through, but also, never crossed in my mind. I want to go make a game. Right. And that was the thing is, a lot of journalists when we were starting out, it was almost like a bridge to go work at a game company. And for me, it's never been about that. It's always been I think I'm stronger and better supporting everybody.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I like what we do. It's fun. G4, you mentioned G4.
G4 is coming back.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. It's this is getting teased now. What are your thoughts on this? Are they reaching out? Are they reaching out to you? Are you going to be involved? What's the plan here?
Yeah, I started hearing about it probably about a year ago. And as I understand it, Tucker Roberts, who's the son of Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, is kind of putting this together. And, G4, there was a place and a time for it. I had a lot of fun working there. It was pre-YouTube and pre-Twitch, right? Yeah. It was sort of the early 2000s. I worked there and then I kind of went to Spike, and there was actually a time where I was kind of working at G4 and Spike and MTV. So yeah, I'm interested to see what they do. There was a couple of years ago, they had reached out to me, or NBC had, because they were trying to do G4 as like an over the top channel. It was a lot of the guys from like USA Network and Sci-Fi. That never happened, but they reached out to me about that. No one's reached out to me about this one yet. I'm curious, like, what they do. You know, everyone has an affinity for G4, and I think there's something to do. You know, my general view now is that I'm not sure people want to watch a linear network about, you know, any topic, right? You know, like, same thing with MTV. It's like, you know, no one watches MTV for music videos. No one really watches MTV anymore. It's like they watch stuff on YouTube, right? So I think it'll be interesting to see how G4 reinvents that brand for the bite-size social media content that, you know, we consume now, and how we consume media. So I think it's a really smart idea to bring it back. I just think they have to be really smart in how they approach what the content is and kind of what G4 stands for. So yeah, I mean, I'll talk to them at some point. I haven't reached out to them. I've talked to some of the hosts, and like, they're, I think, trying to figure out ways to like involve some of those hosts again and do things around it. It's just like, you know, from IGN, like how hard it is to constantly produce content and build stuff around it. So I'll be curious to see how big the ambition is of, like, are they trying to launch a 24/7, you know, network about video games, or are they going to do something that's a little more bite size? So I don't know. Yeah, I'm excited when anyone wants to do more stuff around gaming. There's this other network, Venn, that I think is launching soon, which is like another kind of attempt to do like a video game content network. You know, I found my strength is in doing fewer, bigger things. And yeah, like the Game Awards, you know, that takes me legitimately 6 months of my year to put that together. And I don't think people always realize that, but I sort of have to go away to come back and do big things. And the idea of doing like a daily show or a weekly show, I've done that stuff. And I enjoy it, but it comes at a cost of some of these other things to do. So yeah, like, I'm excited to see what G4 does. I think, you know, I think I wouldn't be surprised if like Olivia and Kevin and, you know, a lot of the hosts come back in some way and get involved in it. And it's fun, right? I mean, that was a big part of my career, and I'd be super supportive of seeing what they do. But yeah, I had heard it was originally coming this year, and then the teaser said 21. So I guess it's probably a little bit further out. And yeah, I'm excited to see what they do.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Well, you hit on, I was just going to go next to the Game Awards, talk about that for a few minutes, but you actually mentioned how it's 6 months out of your year. And I think I wanted to talk a little bit more about that because you're right. I mean, I have a little window into it from some of the stuff that I helped produce at IGN. And I mean, I've never spent 6 months of my year on something like the Game Awards, but like the process for building it, I mean, does it effectively happen year round? Are you more or less starting the next one as soon as the last one airs?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, it depends. Like, you know, in a normal year, like we have to book the theater probably a year out, right? Because we need like 10 days in Microsoft Theater, like build the show and put it together. So there's, you know, competing concerts and events. So yeah, we got to pick a date. And then yeah, the content in that show, you know, like my hand is in pretty much everything. So it's like, you know, last year it's like, well, like came up with the idea, like, let's do something fun with the Muppets and Untitled Goose. And like, let's see if we can get that all together and let's write it. Let's produce it. Let's put it together. Let's, you know, team up churches with Kojima and introduce them to do something. Let's figure out something fun for Green Day to do. Let's talk to Beat Saber. So yeah, there's a lot of like triangulation of things that come together for that show to be what it is. And I'm, you know, very heavily involved in like figuring out the world premieres, working with the studios. Like even this week I've had 3 or 4 calls on like games that are going to get announced at the show and like what's the idea for the trailer, what's a fun way to do this. So yeah, I involve myself pretty intimately in the production of the show and working with the studios on it. And you know, even though I host it and I own it, it's like something where I'm extremely involved, and to my personal detriment, probably I'm very heavily involved in every aspect of that show. But it's, some people will say I'm just sort of a control freak about it, but it's also, I think, because I've sort of lived and survived through a lot of the other award shows and was always frustrated to some degree about what those were. Now the fact that I kind of get to own it and author it is a huge opportunity for me, but I also feel a great obligation to really like make it as good as possible for our industry. So I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it. I'm happy to do it. But as you said, I think people sometimes assume like, oh, he just kind of like starts in October and sees what, you know, what's around. And yeah, no, studios build custom trailers and, you know, sprint towards the Game Awards as their announcement date. And, you know, last year, like with the, you know, the new Xbox reveal, like that doesn't happen overnight. Like that's like months of negotiation to, you know, get that stuff to happen.
Well, you touched on how you've seen other entities, other people controlling it, do it. Now you've got ownership of the Game Awards. Prior to that, of course, you did it with Spike TV. Did Spike ever really get it? It almost seems like going out on your own with it has been the best thing to ever happen to you.
Yeah, you know, I take a positive view of the Spike years in that I learned how to make an award show from some of the best people in the business. Right. And like, you know, I would have never known how to do the Game Awards without kind of the trial by fire that was, you know, the VGAs. And I always say that like Spike really invested in the VGAs over, you know, over a decade. Right. I mean, I'm sure they spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars, like sort of building this show, trying to support the industry at a time when no one else was, right? And, you know, G-Force sort of like kind of did stuff with G4ia, but was never at the level of what Spike did. So it was never the show I fully wanted it to be, but I learned a lot through that. And I still respect the fact that Kevin Kay, the president of Spike, like for many years, like invested in that show when honestly it wasn't really rating huge for them. It was a long investment in gaming, and yes, like for sure there were aspects of it that were kind of silly, and you know, a little too celebrity focused and whatnot. And it was, you know, painful for me on one level. But it was also kind of like the best opportunity our industry had to get some exposure. And look, some people could argue that it would have been better to have nothing, right, than have something that sort of, you know, defeats sort of what the industry might be about. But I think there were a lot, like I was proud of a lot of the big moments that we had over the years at that show. You know, there were some great years, and like the year that Jack Black hosted for Brutal Legend, and you know, we elevated Tim Schafer and he did a whole musical number. Like there were some really things I was proud of over those years. So Spike, I think, got it, but they were also inside a big media organization that needed to make a sexy television show to sell to advertisers. And, you know, that's why, you know, the Jersey Shore cast was there to present, because there was this view that, you know, we had to, gaming wasn't enough, right? And we had to go to all these other talents and celebrities to sort of validate the show and make it feel relevant. And what my view was always that I actually think the gaming audience is really big, and there are tens of millions of gamers, and that's the bullseye you have to hit first, is like delivering a show for that audience. But you know, the producers there for many years like would hear from the sales team about like, we need some big sexy names to, you know, sell it to advertisers. And you know, Tim Schafer and Cliffy B and Hideo Kojima didn't, you know, register for them. So it's kind of inside the structure of a big television network. I understood why the show was what it was, and to Spike's credit, they listened to me and worked with me, and it was collaborative. There were absolutely frustrating aspects of it. But as you said, it kind of led to the Game Awards. And you know, I'm grateful for that, but I look back on it not as it, like, you have to be patient in life with some of these things. And I was always kind of working within the system to learn how to build this to eventually allow me to create the Game Awards. And I always say to people, like, the Game Awards wouldn't happen without all the stuff that I had done before at Spike. So I look back at it as like a good experience. Sure, it was painful for people that watch the show, I'm sure, sometimes, and for those of us that really cared about the industry. But I learned a lot from that time.
Well, to that point, I mean, for me as a viewer, every year I feel like the Game Awards seems to evolve. Like, it started off, I remember I felt like in the first or second time he did it, I was like, man, that was, there's a lot of neat stuff, but boy, that was way too long. So then I noticed, and then I see the next year it gets shorter, and I feel like you are evolving it. You are adapting and growing from it every year. I'm kind of curious to ask you about the ideal balance. This is a hot topic every year, the balance between game reveals and game awards. How do you sort of wrestle with that? Of celebrating these game developers, but you know, you want to have these cool moments of unveiling games that also, quite frankly, bring in viewers as well.
Exactly. No, that's the eternal debate with the show, right? And everyone will have a different opinion on it. My Twitter feed, I do a poll, I think every year around this, saying like, what's more important to you? You know, the awards, the world premieres, and it's usually like 80%+ of people say like world premieres, like that's what they, you know, the audience cares about, or a section of the audience cares about. And to me, you know, it's a magic formula that works for our show, because the game announcements are what drive, as you said, a mass audience into the show, which then means when we give an award to Carol Shaw, or we give an award to the Disco Elysium team, that game is discovered and those developers are seen by tens of millions of people, which I think is really, really powerful as a concept. And look, there are lots of other award shows in the industry, and I'm supportive of them. But, you know, they're often, you know, in front of thousands of people, or, you know, a room of people of their peers, which is really important. But for us, I love the idea that we are exposing tens of millions of people to these developers and their stories in the show. So, you know, if we just did a pure award show, the ratings would be nowhere near what they are now. So it's always a balance between the two. And I think I try and be sort of equitable with that, in having kind of like half awards, half game announcements. And that formula has worked for us, right? I mean, there will always be people that come down on the opinion of like, you didn't present enough awards, or like, why did you present this award in the pre-show or on the side stage? And I'm honored in a way that people have that criticism, because it means the awards really matter to people, right? It's, they're not sort of like throwaways, because, you know, this is like the big award show for gaming, and people really care about the awards. And when they win, you know, I got one of the trophies here. It's like when people win, it's like, it means a lot to people. So we think about that. I'm like, it's not something that doesn't cross our mind, but I think you have to balance it out to, you know, drive the biggest potential audience. And that means the biggest impact. And, you know, when I hear from the Cuphead guys one year, or Celeste team, they're like, wow, our game won a bunch of awards, and we sold so many copies after the Game Awards because there were like so many people watching and discovering. And I remember that happened with Dead Cells too. Awesome. Like, that means something to me, that like, they're winning awards, but they're also, you know, winning hearts and minds and consumers. And that to me is like the reason our show exists, really, is to like help people discover a great game. So if I can do that on a mass scale through these announcements, that's great. And I'd also say, like, the world premieres, like, that's the future of our industry. And I think we'd love to look back, but we want to look forward. And that's what excites me about the show, is like, what hot new thing are we going to announce for next year? I mean, it's the reason we watch E3 or Gamescom or all these other things. So, like, sure, it's marketing, but it's like, it's a preview of where our business is going, and it's only getting better. So I think the world premieres are a really big, important part of the show, and we're never going to lose that piece of it.
Was Joseph Ferris, was handing him a microphone the best thing that ever happened to your show?
Yeah, Joseph's, he's a trip. Oh, no. And he was, you know, I will say with Joseph is like, he knows he's putting on a show for you, right? And it's like, yeah, he was, it's great though. But, you know, we announced his, you know, his game, what was called Hazelight at the time, at the first Game Awards in 2014 with Peter Moore, who's leaving Liverpool. So maybe he's coming back to the gaming industry. But yeah, so Joseph's been great. I mean, we've been talking to him this year because he's got his It Takes Two, his next game. So he's eager to come be a part of the show in some way this year. So we'll see if we can work that out. But yeah, he's, I mean, I love those moments that are unpredictable. And one of the things as an award show producer, what really gets me excited is just every year there's like, you don't know what the moment's going to be, but something you hope happens. And it's like, was it Joseph, or it was like when Sonic Fox won, or the Read It Boy thing with God of War, or trying to think what went viral last year. It's like the Muppets thing, right? With the goose. It's like, you just love those moments, and you hope they're good moments versus like terrible moments. But Joseph's thing, I was always like, I thought it was funny, right? I mean, it wasn't like, F the Game Awards. It was sort of like F, you know, the belief that the Oscars is like the most important award show in the world. So yeah, Joseph's heart was in the right place, and he definitely speaks his mind.
Game Awards, it's going to have to be virtual this year at this point, right? As we record here at the tail end of July.
Yeah, we are. What I will say about it is we have a really interesting plan for the show this year. We're definitely doing it, right? I think a lot of people are like, are you delaying it? You know, the Oscars are being postponed. You're postponing the Game Awards. It's like, we are absolutely not. We'll share more in the coming weeks about it, but it's actually probably going to be our biggest show yet. We are obviously not going to have, you know, 10,000 people in a room together physically for the show. But I think you'll see a little bit of this with how we do Gamescom. Like, we're definitely doing more than just this, right? Of like me being in a room announcing winners. I'm really passionate about doing the show live still versus something pre-recorded. So yeah, we're working on some scenarios for ways we can present the show live with a bit of spectacle to people without, you know, I mean, the public's not going to be able to buy tickets to come to the show and things like that this year. Right. So but there's a lot of work. And honestly, our team is working overtime thinking of like how we present this in a way that celebrates the industry in a bit bigger fashion. So yeah, we're going to do some live stuff. We're still hoping to do like some spectacle and scale to how we do things. But yeah, we're, you know, likely not going to be able to do the traditional show this year. But it's absolutely happening for sure.
So I've got about 20 or so minutes left with you. You mentioned we,
yeah.
So talk to me about Jeff Incorporated for a second. Like how big is your team? What's sort of your average day like and with the crew that you're working with on a regular basis?
Yeah. It depends. I mean, I do a lot myself. Like, you know, this year obviously is different, right? But yeah, normally like a lot of my year is talking with people, visiting developers. Like often most of the summer I'm traveling through kind of Europe and Asia, visiting studios, looking at their products for Game Awards. That's the other thing. It's like I'm very hands-on with everything, right? There's not like a separate team that goes out and handles premieres. Like pretty much everything I hand curate myself. And I have a great team that handles production on the shows and the spectacle of the awards. So as like Kimmy H. Kim, who kind of co-produces the shows with me in terms of the actual like teams and the, you know, the venues and the set and the stage and all that stuff around it. And we have like, yeah, we have a good team that helps kind of produce the shows, but a lot of the editorial stuff is really like driven by me. Like I, you know, personally pitch every game studio on what we're doing with the show. I handle kind of, you know, all the booking of the talent in the show. I handle, you know, I mean, we have obviously an advisory board that kind of helps guide the show a little bit, and you and others at IGN help vote on the awards and select the nominees and winners, which is part of the, you know, the worry last year was like, oh, Jeff's, you know, about to hook up Kojima with the award because he's his buddy. And it's like, you know, that's all completely separate, which I think people understand. But yeah, it's like, you know, cause I'm the face of the show. It comes with some level of scrutiny because so much of me is around it, but yeah, we have a really talented team, that works on our shows. And traditionally that's, you know, we have kind of three big beats a year. We usually do E3, Gamescom, and then the Game Awards. This year, obviously, has been a little bit different because I've been doing the Summer Game Fest stuff and then Game Awards and Gamescom. But yeah, it's a great group of like freelance folks that all kind of come together to build these shows, and our team scales to hundreds of people in a normal year around Game Awards. But yeah, traditionally, like I'm traveling. Every day is different. This year is a little, actually, I have more of a routine this year than I ever have, right? Cause it's like, oh, let me get up, let me go for a run, let me, you know, do right. video calls. Normally I'm racing to a plane. I'm like, oh, I'm flying to London. And then I got to go stop in North Carolina to visit Epic. And then I got to go to, you know, Seattle to go see Reggie or something. So, this year is a little more normal, but yeah, I was never, my career has never been like sitting in an office, you know, with a team, you know, having meetings all day. It's like, I'm very active out there, like meeting with developers, seeing people. I think that's part of the secret to my success, at least, is that I'm, you know, I love talking with people about games and seeing their stuff and visiting them.
Well, you mentioned Hideo Kojima. You are not shy about your personal friendship with him. So like where did that start? What is the origin of your friendship with Hideo Kojima?
The origin of the friendship with Kojima, I think stems back to when I did the final hours of Metal Gear Solid 2 in 2001. I went over to Tokyo. It was right after 9/11. I remember flying on a 747 and there was like no one on the plane. And I went over and visited him and wrote a story about the making of that game. And we just kind of hit it off. I think he's always, you know, he's been interested in kind of Western culture and Hollywood and LA and entertainment. And I think we just had like a common, you know, love of like movies and entertainment and talent. And we just sort of got to talking about things. So I did that with him. And then, you know, for years we didn't really do a lot. And then as VGAs started to become a thing, he was one of the very early supporters of doing big game announcements at VGAs. We did Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, I remember, which was like drama because I think that game leaked out of like Mexico the day of the show. And it was, anyways, it was the same year we announced The Last of Us. We also did a Metal Gear Rising thing with him. So he's just always been like super supportive of my stuff. I find him to just be, you know, a really intellectual person, but deeply human and emotional in how he thinks about things. And you know, we don't really speak the same language. So it's like, it's fascinating that we have this sort of kinship with each other. But yeah, I've always just been a fan of his games and how he thinks about pushing the medium forward, and respecting how, you know, how much he works to like publicize his games and travel the world and meet with fans and understand other cultures. I think there are a lot of Japanese developers that just, you know, they don't think about how their games will do in the West or around the world. And he's just so curious. Like his eyebrows are always raised, like just learning about things. And I love that he hears about a new band and he gets excited about learning about them or, you know, new pieces of culture. So yeah, I've always just like respected him. But again, like people know about my friendship with him because he's so public on social media. But I mean, I have so many great friends in this business, from designers to developers, to honestly, even like the, you know, the executives and the publicists and stuff that I have known for decades. So Kojima is one of my more public sort of friends. But it doesn't mean that I'm, you know, any less friends with Neil Druckmann at Naughty Dog or with, you know, the guys at id Software, or, you know, elsewhere. It's like, I, you know lots of these people. And that's why it's sometimes people think it's like, oh, you know, he's going to throw the awards for Kojima, but it's like, I loved a lot of the games last year and I'm friends with lots of the developers. And that's honestly the hardest thing for me with the awards. And that's why I keep myself out of it is because, you know, it's tough for me when you see people at the after party of the game awards and, you know, they lost game of the year. And it's like, it's, you know, it's a great game. It just didn't get selected. And, you know, people in the gaming industry are naturally competitive because games are competitive. So it's always a difficult thing, but yeah, Kojima's been, you know, an incredible friend and supporter. I was just talking to him a few weeks ago. We did a thing on Summer Game Fest for the PC release of Death Stranding. And yeah, I consider him to be, you know, a really unique voice in our industry with an interesting perspective on games and design. So I will always, you know, support him.
Well, we both grew up playing games just since we were kids. So how much of a thrill was it to be in a video game, to be an NPC in Death Stranding?
Well, it was good, but it was, you know, controversial, I guess. It's funny because, like, I've been in games over the years. Like, Peter Molyneux in Black and White made me a villager that you could throw around in Black and White. There was, like, a little Jeff Keighley, and you could toss it. It's like, you know, that didn't get any attention back in the day. But, yeah, it was look, I'm really careful about making sure that the legitimacy of the awards and what I do is never compromised. And doing the Death Stranding thing was obviously like, I was like excited about it, but I also knew that it would be, you know, somewhat controversial that like he's in a game and I'm, you know, I said, I've been in lots of games over the years. But that actually, I mean, the funny story on that is it didn't actually start as me being an NPC in the game. They scanned me years ago. Cause at one point Kojima had an idea for me to like appear in the Death Stranding world and kind of like host, like, you know, like from the Game Awards, like, oh, I'm in Death Stranding and there's Jeff and he's basically like introducing the next world premiere, which is Death Stranding. And that never happened, but that was kind of the original idea. And then I didn't know what happened with that. It just didn't happen. And then like all of a sudden he surprised me last year. It's like, oh, by the way, like you're in this, you know, you're in the game and here's your character and Matthew Mercer is your voice. And I'm like, cool. So yeah, it was surreal and kind of fun. As you said, like people were asking me recently, like, are you in Cyberpunk? Cause I think a bunch of folks are in that as well. And, yeah, it's a thrill, but I'm also very mindful that like, I have to be, you know, very careful about, you know, I would never like take a role in a game, right. Of like, I'm speaking role and I'm like, you know, a character. So it was kind of a fun nod to me, which I appreciate and was good, but I really like, you know, I listened to everyone last year and heard all the feedback about people being concerned that, you know, it was inappropriate. And I'm like, yeah, I totally understand that perspective. And I think about that. And I don't think I'm going to, you know, it's not a goal of mine to be a main character in a game at some point.
I want to talk to you for our last few minutes here about it's just the industry at large, because I always have fun talking to you about that stuff down at Judges Week. How do you feel? How are you feeling about the new console launches this year? What do you feel like each Microsoft and Sony are doing well? Is Sony's iron grip on that market share dominance permanent? Like, what were you kind of, how are you feeling about the two new machines this year?
It's like my Twitter feed will light up. It's like, yeah, people are, look, I think, so what I will say overall is I'm amazed that two new consoles are coming out this year in this environment, with the pandemic and, you know, like how they manufacture those in this world and still come out. And again, knock on wood, they do come out. But like that's amazing to me, right? It's a true tribute, I think, to everyone working on these systems that's able to happen this year. In terms of the positioning of the machines, look, I think they're going down different paths. And I think PlayStation is in a really strong position. I think, you know, PS5, great machine. The controller, which I've got to play with, is really cool. An amazing lineup of first party games. I mean, they're kind of running the same play that they've run before. Worked really well for them. And I think, you know, the games they showed in their lineup, I mean, I'm really excited. I mean, the SSD stuff looks incredible. So I'm excited about that. Xbox, you know, is playing a different game and is, you know, I think the Game Pass stuff is a really compelling story for them. I think, you know, it's differentiated, right? And we'll see what they do with pricing and whatnot. But I think Xbox is, you know, has a good story as well, and a different story than what Sony is approaching. So we'll see. I mean, I think Xbox has to, you know, really deliver the great first party games, right? I mean, that's always sort of the challenge for them. And, you know, I think Halo had its challenges, you know, last week when they showed it. And I hope that's going to really, like, you know, shape up to be an awesome launch game for them. You know, who knows what Sony has for launch, right? They've been kind of like vague about it. They've got a lot of games coming, but like what's actually coming at launch around it. And overall, it's a different year because, you know, things, a different generation. Cause, you know, I think one of the biggest launch games is going to be Cyberpunk for all these systems, which is, you know, just going to run better on these systems, but it's like forwards and backwards compatibility. So it's different. It's not like, you know, oh, I got, like, you remember, it's like used to be like, oh, I got to keep around my Xbox cause that game's coming out that I want to play on it. And I still got the new one. And it's like, when can I disconnect, you know, PS2? Cause I, you know, I want to hook up my PS3, but there's that game coming out that's only on PS2. So I think there's going to be a lot of blended stuff altogether, but I would say, like, I think Sony has a really strong story to tell. We don't know what the price is there, but I mean, I'm really excited about some of the games that I've seen there and, you know, Sony's mastery of these incredibly rich single player experiences. I think Xbox has a really good story about value for gamers around a lot of diversity of choices. I think their challenge is, I think Sony's challenge will be sort of like the price and the premium experience and making sure that people are able to sort of, you know, purchase into that this year. Xbox's challenge, I think, is that Game Pass is great, but it's got to have the really great flagship games in it, right? And you don't want it to sort of be like your basic cable package where it's like, hey, it's a lot of cool stuff, but like what I really want is HBO. And it's like, you know, those games are outside of Game Pass. And I don't know. I tend to think people, you know, they care more about the really big games that are going to move the needle and not just like, I want to, you know, an okay game to kind of play this weekend. There's a little bit of that. And again, I'm not a great test for that because I get access to so many games already, right? You and I, like, we get all these things shipped to us for free or we get codes. So, you know, the average gamer, there's value there to that. So it's kind of a long-winded answer, but I would say I'm excited about the new consoles. I think both platforms have really unique, interesting stories to tell. But no, I don't see anything right now from Xbox that makes me feel like, you know, it's going to dramatically alter sort of the course of things. But, you know, we have to see what the prices are on these things. Like, that's going to be like a big question of like, you know, is there a big difference between the prices of the two systems? And the other thing is like, you know, the Xbox stuff, I still think they have to prove kind of the world's most powerful console thing. Like, they keep talking about that. And, you know, I don't need to cite all the specs and stuff, but I still think they really need to kind of show that. If it is, you know, if Series X really is most powerful, it's like, I want to see the games that really demonstrate that. And I haven't seen that yet. And I'm not sure power really is the be all and end all. It's like it comes down to the games and the content. And I think no matter what system you buy, you're going to end up, you know, having a lot of fun with them. So yeah, I'm excited. I think like they're both going to be really good machines. And I think Game Pass and xCloud is going to move the industry in a really interesting direction too.
Yeah, well, we're recording for posterity's sake. It's July 31st, so maybe by the time this airs,
prices
have been
yeah.
announced. I guess we'll find out. I should just leak the price
like I did that one year at E3. It's so funny. Like I still get that in my Twitter feed, and people are like, "You're going to leak the price because you did E3," and it's like, "Yeah, I will say like the no, it's we'll see. I feel like I don't know. And you know, there's rumors that Xbox has this Lockhart, which is like a cheaper Xbox, and then you know, Sony's got the regular one and the all digital. So look, people love to debate this stuff. And I honestly sometimes don't even talk about this stuff on Twitter because it's just like it becomes so controversial about like, you know, which system are you, people were counting how many tweets I was putting up about like Xbox versus PlayStation. And I'm like, guys, it's like I'm just gonna talk about, you know, what's out there and what I'm excited about. And it's okay if I'm like excited about one system and a game on a different system. And yeah, that whole sort of console warriors mentality, I just don't think about things that way. It's like, look, people always say like, oh, he's a PlayStation fanboy. And it's like, well, but like we announced the new Xbox at Game Awards last year. Like that was a massive moment. Like you forget about that. And it's look, I traditionally have really loved a lot of the exclusive PlayStation games. And those have been like super meaningful to me from my sort of adventure game roots. Like I really love rich story driven tales, but I've also like, I've loved stuff on Xbox as well. And I sure hope that Halo's amazing and, you know, Fable, I'm super excited about that. And like Xbox has some great stuff in the pipeline from an exclusive first party perspective. I just think it's going to be a few years till we get all of it.
Right. Before I let you go, should E3 come back in its traditional form, assuming we can all congregate in the future? I mean, you do the YouTube Coliseum down there for them, but just separating that sort of business interest as
all
it were,
the controversial
as an industry thing.
Yeah, look,
as an industry thing, do you want E3 come back?
Yeah, like I love E3. I've been to every E3, and it really broke my heart when I decided not to do it this year before, you know, it got canceled. My whole thing with E3 is that it really needs to evolve as a concept, and you will find no bigger fan of what E3 represents than me. And part of the reason I kind of broke up with what E3 was going to be this year is I did not believe that it was going to represent the industry in the right way and in the sort of progressive way that it needed to be. And that was hard for me, but I kind of had to take a stand for that. You know, and we did the Summer Game Fest thing kind of as, you know, a response to just like not having an E3. I wasn't, you know, people were like, did you leave E3 to launch Summer Game Fest? And like, no, I left E3 thinking that E3 was going on and I just wasn't going to be a part of it. And then as the sort of cards fell, I ended up doing the Summer Game Fest thing. So we had something. And people rightfully have said like, hey, Summer Game Fest, it's too spread out. It's 4 months. Why isn't it all in 2 weeks? And I'm like, I hear you and I agree with you. It's just like, given the way things were breaking down with COVID and everything, like we had to cast a wide net this year to capture all the events. Is it ideal? No, but it's better than the other option, which was nil of like nothing. So it was, and like you guys, IGN, Summer Gaming, like you guys did something too. It's like we kind of fill that void. So, you know, will there be a Summer Game Fest next year? Maybe. Will it be the same length? I hope if, you know, we do it, it's like we can condense it all down into a month or something, right? But that requires all the game companies and everyone to kind of align around that and like make that work. And one of the things this year was like, I knew pretty early on that Microsoft was going to be in July, not in June, and Sony was going to be there. And it's like, sorry, guys, like, you know, you have two platforms 6 weeks apart. We got to, you know, kind of cast a wider net. So, you know, E3 really matters to me. I'm hopeful that E3 finds a way to evolve. And I put, you know, I haven't really talked a lot about this, but I put a lot of ideas in front of the ESA on how I wanted to see E3 evolve. And a lot of them are, you know, very digital focused and global focused. And it just didn't seem like they were ready to kind of take that leap. And I understand because they're, you know, it's a legacy business of like a trade show that has to evolve into something new. It's not unlike when I was at Viacom, you know, I was doing a television award show. And what ended up being the best thing for me and everyone, I think, was just sort of like making a break from that versus trying to transition right. that into a digital show. That's when we got VGX, right? Remember that? Me and Joel McHale. And like, it was kind of better to just break and do something brand new. So that's kind of what happened this year. I was like, I just think we need to try some of these ideas in a brand new way this year, see how they work. I'm really happy with how the Summer Game Fest stuff has gone overall. I agree. It's been too spread out. But yeah, I mean, E3's announced dates for next year. I don't know if people are going to be able to gather physically for much next year even, right? I mean, you hear about Google with all their employees being out through next summer. Like, I don't know. We'll see. So I'm the first person who would be love to see a really strong digital E3. That brand means a lot to the industry, and I'm totally open to, you know, working on that. It just, I think, has to be under the right circumstances with the right vision and approach for it. So I'd love to see E3, you know, come back in a strong way. And if not, totally happy to keep building the Summer Game Fest thing as well, or something new. So I'm flexible in that regard. But yeah, I miss E3, right? Like, I miss seeing you and everyone in the industry and having that runoff. Like, people always say to me, like, why is Summer Game Fest so spread out? Like, I love singular events. Like, we do that with Gamescom Opening Night Live. We do that with the Game Awards, right? That's all in 2 hours. We like pack everything together. So I love that concept of everything being this runoff and this kind of jam-packed week. And even personally for me, this summer stuff's been tough because like we're constantly doing stuff. And I kind of love we do E3 and then I get to go on vacation and go work on Game Awards. So yeah, like it's obviously, you know, a very important event to me every year. And I hope that it comes back in some form. It would be sad if E3 just sort of like disappears. Like that's not what I want.
I'm with you. Yeah. And what I think a lot of people may not understand is you didn't start on Summer Game Fest and we didn't start on Summer of Gaming until literally the day E3 was officially canceled. And then we had to scramble. Yeah. We're both scrambling to put these things together in weeks in what would normally be planned out over months. So,
oh, yeah. No, that's the thing. Like, I had no plans. And like, honestly, there was a plan for like this digital E3 thing that didn't come together. And I was like, you know, I had seen those plans. I'm like, I don't think this is going to work either. And yeah, I said it was out of necessity that game companies started calling me saying like, hey, can you pull us together into something? So as you said, the option was kind of nothing or this type of stuff. And I'm really happy that the industry rallied behind this. You know, the Summer Game Fest thing, it wasn't really a job. It wasn't for the money. It was just like, I think we need to come up with something as a container. And we've learned a lot about how to do these digital events. And I agree with consumers that are like, it's so spread out. It's, you know, drip, drip, drip. I want everything in 1 week. And like, I agree, but these games are all being made work from home. Schedules are being delayed. People don't know if their games are going to come out. Like, we're honestly lucky that we get what we get this year, given the circumstances that the world is in. I think sometimes people forget that, that they expect everything to be like, just like normal. And it's like, guys, like, you're probably affected in your own life in some way. And these game developers are too. So, you know, 21 hopefully will be different, but some of the lessons learned from this summer, I hope will apply to, you know, however E3 or whatever happens next year gets executed.
Well, in the meantime, we can look forward to Mr. Jeff Keighley on Gamescom Opening Night Live coming up, I guess, as this airs very, very soon. And then
yes, August 27th, Thursday is when Opening Night Live is. And I know IGN's got coverage for the next few days. So yes, we're going to do a digital Gamescom this year.
Yes, indeed. Looking forward to that. And then the Game Awards in some fashion. You heard Jeff talk about it later on in the year. And then we'll see what comes around for E3 next year. And then, of course, the final hours of Half-Life Alyx available now on Steam.
All my plugs. I love it.
Fantastic look back at a chronicle of the entire, not just Alyx process, but the last like 10 plus years of Valve. It's really fascinating if you're interested in sort of the what goes into this incredible myth, this mythological status that Valve has attained. Jeff Keighley, it's always good to see you, my friend.
Thanks, Ryan. Honored to be on here. Thanks for inviting me on. And yeah, we will hopefully see you in person sometime soon.
I look forward to it. For more from the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry, be sure to check with me every month for a new episode of IGN Unfiltered.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of supernatural horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side passage?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
You to save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.